Today's show is sponsored by Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/baldmove and using the promo code baldmove. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 6, Episode 3, entitled Oathbreaker. I think I've come to the conclusion that this is an ironic name.
I don't know. I got some feedback that identifies all kinds of Oathbreakers.
Okay.
Broken oaths are in the eyes of the beholders.
Right. I think the most prominent one, the one that we're all supposed to be thinking about, though, seems like Jon Snow.
Yeah.
And I think it's ironically named because he's not actually an Oathbreaker, even though what he's doing would make any other Lord Commander of the Night's Watch an Oathbreaker.
Yeah.
That's how I read it anyway.
I tend to broadly agree with you. I think that's if you want to dig deeper and find more, well, that's what we're here for.
Right.
But I think it's also a pretty plain reading of, I don't know if it's ironic or if they're actually teasing a bigger conflict to come. Those things are all on the table, but, yeah.
Sure. Okay.
Any additional thoughts or, like, any shifts of opinion after you watched it a couple more times or again?
No. I think I'm sticking with my, you know, first opinion on it. There were some scenes that I really liked, some scenes that made the episode, and then some scenes that were just okay, or maybe not even great.
I think this episode suffered a lot more than many in recent memory for having the just like, okay, you get 10 minutes rule. You know, like it's
for each story.
Yeah, like we only have time to barely. And so it felt like maybe that scene with Tyrion wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't like our impatience to see that story develop more.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's a couple of good thoughts and feedback about what that scene was trying to impress upon us, which I kind of like made me. It's not like I think the scene is suddenly artful or well done, but maybe I see what they were trying to go for.
Yeah. I have a slightly changed opinion on that scene in particular, but for the most part, nah, hasn't really changed.
Right on.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
What do you want to talk about before we get to...
Right before we get to the main thing, I just want to real briefly mention that we threw out as a lark these dead Lannister sunglasses, the stones in your eyes novelty sunglasses, thinking nothing would come of them. We sold out the inventory in like 3 hours. So there's a lot of people that went, and when our shopping cart sells out, it removes it from the inventory so you couldn't even see it. You know, response was successful enough that we decided to do another run at them. If you order them today, go to baldmove.com/shop, check them out. If you want to order them, it's going to be like 4 to 6 week delivery because we actually have to have these manufactured. The ones that got the early orders will probably get out next week, but, just want to let you know if you want to check out the dead Lannister sunglasses and cosplay as a dead Lannister or for whatever reason, have them, it's at baldmove.com/shop. All right.
Let's get into the recap. We start with Davos and Melisandre seeing Jon awake, and he's kind of freaking out. They're kind of freaking out. Everybody doesn't know what to make of this scenario here. Melisandre wants to know what Jon Snow saw on the other side. He says nothing. Nothing. I saw
nothing.
Knows
nothing. He sees nothing.
Hey, what good are you? Then Davos tells Jon to use this second chance he's got to clean up as much shit as he can in Westeros.
Yep.
And he starts... Well,
Jon Snow, well, the stall shoveler.
he goes out of the courtyard and, you know, Tormund tells him he's got a tiny Johnson. Ed questions whether he's still himself. Like, people are just being kind of shitty to a guy who just came back from death.
I don't know. They all have a special relationship. What So I thought it was interesting how Mel is anxious to hear what John saw.
Right.
And he says nothing, which also echoes what Beric Dondarrion told her in when she asked him the same question. He said, I saw nothing. My lady is darkness. Hmm. And it also, on second watch, made a little bit more sense about why she was a little bit easily cowed or like dismissed, because I feel like that still took the wind out of her sails that, okay, well, you kind of sort of were brought back to life by my intervention, but it would be like if, you know, you raised the dead Christian mythos style and asked a person what they saw, and they're like, nothing. Like, there's no heaven, there's no bright lights. I thought that maybe that's still so far from what she perceives as the realities of her faith, that it's still like, okay, I'm glad I can do something, but I don't know what the hell I'm doing. What do you think?
Right. Yeah. And I don't know what she expected him to say. Like, does she have something in mind that she thought?
I was standing beside the Lord of Light and he was wreathed in flames. It's right. So beautiful. I mean, I don't know.
And he said, you aren't supposed to be here. Get the fuck out.
Yeah. Your time is not done. Go back. You must become the poop smith of Westeros, Jon Snow.
So I don't know what she actually wanted there, but I feel like hearing that there's nothing shouldn't really deter her in her beliefs at this point, right? Hmm. Clearly what she did worked. Something brought Jon Snow back. So there's clearly not nothing out there, even if he didn't see anything in death.
Yeah. But the zeal of the true believer, it's not like, whatever, man, like I can fit any, it's more of like a specific belief and you have to believe that or else, especially if you've been consigning children to the fires. If you've been trying to murder right. other young men, I don't know. I feel like that might not be enough for her. I don't know exactly where they're going with her. Is her story over?
No, I don't think so. I mean, she clearly is pursuing this. I mean, she says, look, yeah. Stannis wasn't this prince that I saw, but someone has to be.
Sure.
And so she's, you know, groveling before Jon here.
Was she trying to cheat, like get some inside info into who that, like, I feel like that she was wanting to go down this path of like, oh, maybe you're the prince that was promised. And Davos right. seemed like he shut that down pretty quick. Like, almost like, oh, okay, whatever. Get out of here, crazy lady.
Right. He's more like, I don't want to hear this shit. Go. Yeah. I got actual business to talk to John about.
I got something useful to say.
Right. So we go over to Sam and Gilly and the baby who are sailing somewhere. We don't know. We think we know where at the beginning of this scene, but it turns out we don't. Sam is fighting seasickness, and he's losing. He's losing big.
Seasickness is the fucking worst, by the way.
Yeah.
I've had the displeasure of being seasick once or twice before, and it's bad.
Because you can't get away from it.
Yeah, and I remember the first time there was like half of us seasick and half of us wasn't, and the captain of the boat was like encouraging us all just to throw up and get it over with. So,
right.
And I hate throwing up. It's like the worst. My body for some reason fights it like it's a battle that it doesn't want to lose. Uh-huh. And one of my companions decided to go ahead and chum up the water. And I asked him, I'm like, hey man, do you feel better? And he's like, no. So I'm like, okay. Going to just stare at the horizon and try not to hurl.
Wow.
And being down like in the hold where you can't, because that's like, you know, yeah. your inner ear telling you one thing and your brain and your eyes telling the other. I can't even imagine being in the bowels of a boat, not being able to see out. It's just like, oh, yikes. It's terrible.
Yeah, haven't really been seasick, so wouldn't know. But he eventually tells Gilly, look, I'm not dropping you off at the Citadel or Old Town. You can't stay there. Instead, he's dropping her off with the baby at his parents' house in Hornhill. Is that the name of this place?
Yeah, it's the name of his father's keep.
Okay. She's not super happy that they're splitting up, but she kind of comes around when Sam levels with her and says, I'm just trying to keep you guys safe.
Yeah. I thought that was I like this scene because she's right to be hurt that he is going back on the literal word. That uh-huh. he gave her, but also she's reasonable enough to see that he just wants him to be safe.
Right.
And he's got no godly power. He has no benefactors or powerful people looking after him at the Citadel, so mm-hmm. he can't do the, well, yeah, this is a men's only institution, but, you know, I know Jon Snow. Right. I liked it. I felt like a very, a very reasonable, healthy relationship going on here.
Yeah, a lot of people I saw didn't like this scene. They think it's boring. They think it's pointless. I think it's necessary. I think at some point you have to come around and show...
Man, if you think...
Where he's dropping off Gilly. Because if he arrives at the Citadel and just no Gilly, no baby...
Yeah.
We're all like, what the fuck?
Plus, it's like, if you think it's boring just the concept of Sam, this bookish nerd who's found out so much with almost no help going to the archive of all knowledge in Westeros, like, I don't know what to say to you. And you're right. If they'd have just showed him, like, you know, oh, yeah, I dropped off my kid and baby at the house, and, you know, maybe, well, I just... There's no way they could have won in that situation. So
yeah, I mean, I'm mostly with you. I think people are just tired of Sam wants to protect his family shit over and over and over. Like, it's his theme. We get it.
But the thing that's different is I feel like every time we come back and visit these two, they're more of a, you know, this unconventional nuclear family.
Right.
You know, it's like there was some resistance to that. And now that, you know, they're it's even more like proclaiming that they're just – essentially husband and wife with this adopted baby. By the way, kind of surprised that the seed of Craster is a cute baby.
Okay.
And Gilly's, you know, on the homely side, and Craster is just, he's Craster, crusty old Craster.
Yep.
Pretty good looking blonde, blue-eyed baby boy.
Right.
So
just give him a few years.
He'll... The seed is not so strong. It's...
I'm ready to move on. Bran and Tree Man are warging around time, actually. They're watching Ned and Hallen Reed kill Sir Arthur Dayne in front of this big-ass tower. Ned heads off toward the tower, and Bran calls after him, and he seems to hear Bran. Like, after this fight goes on, he seems to hear him, but then Mr. Roots pulls him out of the vision.
Yep.
And Bran complains once again about not being able to stay. Yeah. And the old tree guy tells him, you have a lot to learn before you leave.
Yes.
Essentially.
You have a lot? You have everything.
Everything.
You're going to be the opposite of Jon Snow.
Right.
There's a lot to talk about here.
There is.
Yeah.
Where do you want to start?
I don't know, man.
Badass fight scene. I enjoyed it.
And you know what? I thought, even though I wish they'd left the more, you know, colorful twirling of the swords out, I do admire the way they staged this fight because...
Yes.
You know, the most important thing is when you're fighting one guy versus a bunch is you don't cheat. You don't do the old 80s ninja movie where the white ninja squares off against 50 black ninjas that... I'm talking uniforms, not racial.
Right.
And they oblige him by just one at a time attacking, never pressing the advantage. Here, I felt like... It was all about Dane's footwork, and he's just desperately trying to keep the fight in front of him.
Yep.
Successfully. Because they're all attacking him simultaneously and trying to get their licks in where they can.
They are, yeah. And he's using both his ability with his swords and, like you said, his maneuvering.
Yes.
Just like the way he kind of pushes out of that circle and gets them all to his front where he can fight them, I thought was really good. And I'm with you. It never felt like they were cheating on this fight.
Yeah, and, you know, again, I don't know why they did the twirls, because the twirls were just flourishes. It to me, detracted from the otherwise awesomeness of the fight. I also liked how Howland Reed listened to Bald Move Number 2, which is always play dead.
Right.
If he had been on his hands and knees scabbering to his sword, he might have gotten killed and not been able to stab Sir Arthur Dayne in the back.
Yep.
Also, I thought that was interesting. What was your read of Ned killing Dayne at the end?
Ned doesn't kill him.
Well, he does. He's the one that makes the killing stroke.
Really? You're going to give him the kill? All right, I give the kill to Hallen Reed, frankly.
No, I'm saying it's a fact that he was still... I'm not saying that he wouldn't have died, but it's almost like a death... Okay, you're not playing along, so let me steer.
You're right, the death stroke, fine.
And there's almost like a desperation in Ned's, like, actions. Like, he's looking at Dayne, he's looking at Howland Reed, and he's like, shit, do you think that he was trying to cover, like, Howland Reed's honor, his own honor, that it's so un-Stark-like to knife someone in the back that he's like, okay, so when we later tell this story, you know, it's one of those guys like that... That kid had a real gun, and he was reaching for his waistband, and we were justified in doing this. There's clearly something, because Bran was blown away that his dad would be a party of this.
Yeah.
That the legend has it that, you know, Ned just squared off against the greatest swordsman in the Seven Kingdoms and beat him straight up.
Right, and that's what his dad has told him 1,000 times, apparently.
Or I don't know that it's...
He's heard the story 1,000 times.
Because I also feel like it's un-Ned-like for him to boast, especially as we see how it actually went down.
Right.
I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, and they said as much in the after, not after the thrones, but the thing that the Double D's do,
yeah,
where
the
they
insider.
Get interviewed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, inside the thrones. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They've got so many different...
I thought what they said was oddly unsatisfying. Like, they said a lot, but it wasn't illuminating, because I don't... You know, it's not like Ned stabbed the guy in the back. I felt like the point was made that Ned probably would have died there had it not been
right.
for his less chivalrous friend.
Certainly. Yeah.
And why would Ned lie about that, or allow a lie to be spread? Is it to protect Howland? There's more to this story. Obviously, you hear a woman scream in the tower, and they go off. Everyone goes off to investigate it. You know, the fact that Ned apparently heard Bran cry out. Like, there's a lot of crazy shit to talk about and speculate, probably in the spoiler edition.
Yeah, I've got a lot of other stuff to wonder about here. Like, if... It appears to me that Bran is just buying into this whole hog,
sure.
right? Like, you're showing me actual, factual events from the past. I don't know why Bran assumes that, because certainly it's within everyone's bag of tricks here to deceive and to frame things in a light that makes it look more favorable for them. Why would Bran believe that this old tree guy isn't showing him false visions or... just manipulating him to try to get him to do the thing he wants.
Because he's never seen Star Wars, and he's unfamiliar with Obi-Wan Kenobi's from a certain point of view bullshit. He's
right.
Not savvy enough to know that this old man could be telling him a self-serving version of and that's the thing.
I guess why are we as viewers taking it for granted? Because Bran is?
I don't know that all viewers are. Like,
okay.
I'm, in fact, some things that he said here, like, I've been stuck here for 1,000 years, I've been waiting for you. Even the fact that you can leave, like, I'm really wondering what kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi-type bullshit is going on here. Because it's one of those situations where, you know, I always speculate about the faceless men. Like, Arya's just going to become a faceless man and then kill whoever they want her to kill.
Right.
Or is she going to be like, fuck this, I'm out. If this, like, oh, you're is this going to be something where Bran learns everything, and now the old man's like, you're free to go, but Bran realizes that knowing what he knows now, if he left, it would be an abandoning of, like, all hope in the world, that he has to plug himself. Like, I just wonder if there aren't some real handcuffs being put on these characters.
Right.
By the choices they're making, even as the people advising them are telling them that, no, everything's cool.
Yeah.
So
it could be.
Not every show watcher is thinking. I'm certainly looking for what's the catch.
Yeah.
What's the catch here, Bran? You're going to get universal knowledge, all these fantastic powers, and you're just going to be free to go out in the world and do whatever. I mean, that could be.
Maybe. It just doesn't seem like the style of people with authority.
Yeah.
The other thing is, taking it back to Star Wars, I feel like there might be a Luke on Dagobah moment with Yoda where he realizes, hey, I need to go off and do this thing real quick. Either his friends are in danger
sure.
or something calls him away.
Anytime
before
you got
his
visions,
knowledge is complete.
We know that this world right now, like, think
right.
of any of the horrifying things Bran could be privy to, like things involving his sister.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh my God, my whole family is in trouble
they
still.
Need me.
Yeah, I've got these powers. Yeah, totally. Totally.
I could totally see that happening.
Like, you only know half of everything. You must stay. And it's
right.
like, well, try to stop me. You're a fucking stuck in a tree.
Right. Are you going to fireball me?
Come yeah, on. Right? I'm the chosen one. Come on.
Okay, let's move on. Danny's taken to the city of Bacal Widows. I don't know the name of this place.
Vaz. Jesus. I thought I had the pronunciation in my head, but it's Vaz Dothrak, I think is how you pronounce it.
Dothrak?
It's their capital city.
Huh, okay.
That is as a capital city as a wandering tribe of nomads can have, you know?
Right.
It's where they dump off their widows.
Yeah, essentially. The eldest of the widows takes the queen clothes from Daenerys and gives her a used potato sack to live in for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then she delivers this lesson about believing in a false destiny and tells Dany that there will be some kind of council this Kalar Vejvin, to however you say it.
Yeah, you
to determine what to do with her now that she's gone out into the world after Khal Drogo's death.
Yeah,
apparently that's like I would have liked if they could have established maybe a little bit more of the culture here before it's just brought up
and,
in the most important of ways. Like I would have liked to understand the ramifications of what's happening here to her without having to be told that exactly in this scene.
Well, and I kind of wanted for Dany to be a little bit more defensive of herself. Like, yeah, you were here when I ate that heart. Did you hear about all what all the old crones said about me?
Uh-huh.
Like, it's not like this wasn't some foolish schoolgirl dream I had. You told me.
Right.
That my husband and I would have the stallion that mounts the fucking world. What the fuck? And also, no one told me about this whole, you're a widow now, you gotta dare all this fuck off and left me there with all the invalids and cripples and old and the elderly. Like, I felt like Dany, there was some room for Dany to be like, just wait a fucking minute here. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, because also the old woman wasn't necessarily cruel to her. She was just kind of matter-of-fact, like, you thought one thing, it's the other. You know, she's Marlo Stanfielded him.
Kind of saying that we all thought that at one point.
Sure.
Like, I was naive and young, and I was married to a cow who I thought was going to conquer the world.
Sure.
And I was going to be by his side, and now he's dead.
But you can also see how events are maneuvering that all the cow, not just one, but all the Khalasars are going to be here meeting about what to do about Dany, which implies that all of the Dothraki are going to be in one spot for her to, you know, do fire dragon impressive shit and wow them and over. I don't know how that's going to happen. You also got Jorah and Fuckface McGee,
Dario
out in the wilderness tracking her. There's like a lot of stuff coming to a head, and I guess we'll have to see what happens. What is the worst case scenario here? Do they put her to death? Do they sell her off into slavery?
I felt like the worst case scenario was death.
And also, I guess I thought that, like, these widows had a lot more power within their society as far as, like, you know, yeah, the cows go out there and kick the ass, but, like, they're the ones that kind of, like, I'd always envision them kind of being, like, oh, fuck. What are those guys in 300 that King Leonidas climbed the mountain to go talk to?
I don't remember the name.
That leered over the oracles. But I kind of thought that, like, they have, like, this spiritual power to where, like, the cows, you know, they can't just do whatever they want. They can't, like, defy the will of these widows. That was kind of the checks and balances to society. Yeah. But it seems like that, no, this decision about maybe once she gets into the Dosh Kaleen, the collection of widows, then she'll be beyond their touch. But it seems like it's up to them to decide since she broke their unwritten rules. I don't know.
Right, and I didn't know like about the special case thing with Daenerys going out of the world.
This is
the problem I have with fantasy worlds, right? Like the rules aren't like I don't understand the culture. I mean, it's not just fantasy worlds; it's any literature or work of fiction where the culture is different from what I'm familiar with.
Yeah,
you just don't know, and so I feel like they should have maybe set that up better so I knew the consequences going in.
Well, I'll push back a little bit because I do feel like there's lots of good reasons why, because Dany was sold into slavery. She was just property. She didn't speak the language. She she was learning on the job, and in the middle of the job she had this curve thrown at her. So it's like it you know, there's good in universe reasons for us to be as confused as Dany is in this situation. Whereas you know, a lot of fantasy works don't have that, because it's like, well, you live in this world. Why the fuck don't you know how it works?
Sure, yeah.
You know, but she's literally an outsider, so she's a good stand-in for the viewer. I don't mind it so much. It's just, it's one of those things where it's frustrating to not know. And also to have, like, okay, well, I've got these objections. I'd like to see Dany, in her 5 minutes of screen time, level some of these objections at these, like, old ladies.
Right.
You know, if you're the fucking mother of dragons and breaker of chains, then, like, why are you just okay? You got the leather jerkin put upon you. Did you lose your powers? Like, come hit back at him. You know, did you choke down that horse heart for nothing? Did they just say that? Is that something? Is that some bullshit they say to everybody? Oh yes, yeah. You scarf down the horse heart, lady. You're gonna be the mother of everything, the way we were. Like, I don't know.
Yep.
It's like the Cracker Jack prize. I don't know.
Yeah, it could just be a prank they play on all the new New wives of cows.
The prophecy is essentially drink more Ovaltine. Who knows?
So we go over to Varys in Marine, and he's got Vala, the prostitute who killed some of these Unsullied for the Sons of the Harpy.
Yeah.
A few episodes back. She's brought to him, and he tells her that she can either name the people who put her up to it, or he'll have her killed, leaving her young son to fend for himself. But then he offers a third option, tell him the names, and he'll put her and her son on a boat to Pentos with a big bag of silver.
Fat sacks of silver.
Yeah. So kind of coming at this from both ends, right?
Sure.
Laying out all the consequences and then providing his own way out.
What's the chances that she makes it to Pentos alive?
Probably not great.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that's going to be a plot point that, you know, Varys wants to make people happy, but it's really going to damage his reputation if the Sons of the Harpy are able to get their hands on her anyway.
Right. And I feel like the interesting thing to do here, now that Varys has some form of power in Meereen, is to have these two spy networks work against each other and battle it out.
Certainly.
In the shadows. So that would make a lot of sense if she gets killed.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, well, they must have found out what I wanted. Their spy networks are good.
Also, is that the fact that he implies that he already has birds set up in these other competing slave cities?
Seems like it.
You know, Varys is busy in the off seasons of the last few seasons. And he's been clearly, him bringing Tyrion to Dany wasn't the beginning of his plan. It seems like he was already halfway through. So I'm curious about, getting into the next scene, what the loyalties of these other little birds are.
Okay. Well, we're not quite there yet.
No.
Tyrion then tries to get Grey Worm and Missandei to converse with him. Comedy ensues, if you want to call it that. Finally, Varys comes in to save the scene with the news that the masters in the other cities in the area are funding the Sons of the Harpies. And those other cities are Yunkai, Astapor, and Volantis. Tyrion asks if Varys can get a message to people in those cities, and he says yes.
What kind of message are we talking about? Are we talking about, like, hey, we want to sue for peace, or are we talking about a fish in a newspaper with a bulletproof vest kind of message?
I don't know.
The wise masters are sleeping with the fishes. Can they just hear whispers, or can those little tiny hands wring necks, or can they drop?
They probably just send whispers to the people, to the hands who can.
Yeah, I wonder.
I don't know how much. I don't yet understand what influence or how much influence Varys has over in those other cities.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's any way to tell at the moment.
But I don't know.
It's exciting.
Yeah, so the one thing I want to mention on this drinking game thing is he asks him what did they normally talk about, and Grey Worm talks about how he reports to Missandei in surprising detail the activities of the Unsullied patrols and their results and what they find out. Is there any even a shade, because I got a couple people emailing me this, is there even a hint that maybe Missandei is part of the conspiracy?
I didn't get that.
I mean, she's the queen, because the one thing that I was going to say to everyone that wrote in was like, well, she's the queen's handmaiden. Everything that Dany hears, she's going to hear anyway. So, like, whatever Grey Worm is saying as chit-chat is going to be a subset of her total knowledge that she gets as the queen's handmaiden.
Sure.
Or not just handmaiden, she's like her translator, advisor. Like that's kind of giving her short shrift. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that this is evidence that she's part of the conspiracy.
Yeah, I've never really seen her loyalties lie anywhere but with Dany.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I kind of got the impression that the prostitute in the earlier scene was not a former slave; that she was one of the ruling class, because else what was her motivation for turning against Dany?
Right.
Money, like a return to power. She seemed to be very upset about their liberation, which doesn't fit in with like a slave whore kind of character.
Uh-huh.
So Missandei is a true, you can tell she detests this whole way of life and she's very invested in bringing it down. I don't even know. That would be almost like a broken character moment if she turns out to be one of the Sons of the Harpies.
Yeah, it just wouldn't feel right to me either.
Yeah, okay. Just wanted to run it by you.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Let me throw something out here that I read on Reddit.
Oh, Jesus.
That made me re-contemplate this scene. And I might be stepping on some feedback toes, but what do you make of the idea that Tyrion, this whole discussion, this comedic thing between Tyrion and these two slaves, is to show that Tyrion, like Dany, just didn't understand these lives, these people?
Serving up a lot of slices of dry pie here, Jim.
Got to do it.
No, I think that's actually that's exactly the point, is that he is so culturally and linguistically out of his place that none of his none of his tricks, like the, you know, and Grey Worm and Missandei are giving him nothing. Yeah. Whereas his opponents in Westeros would at least be understanding what he's trying to get at and would be giving him some reaction that he could play with. But this is just like, you know, funniest comedian in the world goes in front of a hall and no one's laughing. Mm-hmm. They're going to start, you know, sweating and flopping and be just completely flustered. So maybe that's the point. He's not funny. He's making dickless jokes in front of a guy who's, you know,
right.
It's that's the point, that he's out of his element.
And so much so that he might not even be the right guy for this job, and that Varys might be the one who's going to be more capable in this situation, especially when you look at last episode where they're walking through the city and Varys is like, you look completely out of place.
Sure.
Here. You don't walk like these people. You don't look like them. You don't know anything about them. And I felt like this scene was also, I thought it was good to point out that this scene is also more of that.
Yeah, I don't know about that, because I do think that there is some stuff that Tyrion brings to the table that Varys doesn't. For example, he's just that, you know, Varys is savvy, but Tyrion is informed.
Sure.
So yeah. I just think that instead of, like, he's essentially the most awesome character ever, and everyone loves him, but that was in Westeros, now he's in here, and, like, there's rolling that back a little bit.
Yeah.
So I actually find the scene, like, yeah, I guess I wasn't supposed to think it's funny, because it's Tyrion bombing, essentially.
Right. Right. So Qyburn's gathered all of Varys' little birds in his dungeon, the ones back in King's Landing anyway, and he's giving them candy to co-opt them. Cersei and Jaime show up. Jaime wants vengeance via the mountain. Cersei wants to know the names of the people who are speaking badly about her.
Yep.
I love the line from Jaime when Cersei's going on about, oh, we only have to kill one, and implies that the mountain is going to do this combat. And he's like, that's one trial by combat I want to watch.
Sure.
Because that's just the audience, right? Like, yeah. Bring us that trial by combat.
Yes. Yes.
We want to see the High Sparrow himself go up against the mountain.
And he starts twirling the spear like Oberyn, and
then you know what's coming.
No, that's interesting. I like the fact that they teased this trial that's coming up, so they haven't forgotten about it.
Yeah.
We certainly haven't. And it's great. And also, I think we're supposed to question about these children and these birds of where their loyalties do lie, because they do seem like they miss. On the one hand, Qyburn seems like he's super nice. He's healing the kids. He's making their potentially abuse. Did you get that subtext? The potentially abusive father has been made to disappear.
People were saying it might be the penis joke. The Cersei looked at my dick and licked her lips guy.
Oh,
from last episode.
That's. I don't know if there's any evidence for that, but sure.
Right.
But no, it's like, I think it's funny how, like, I felt like, oh, this guy's lost his son, but then the reaction between both Qyburn and the kid is like, oh, well, maybe the guy needed to go.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was great, and I guess we should move on to the small council.
Yeah. Yeah, the hand, that's Kevin, right?
Kevin Lannister, yep.
Meeting with Lady Olenna and some other Tyrells. To figure out what to do about Margaery being locked up. Jaime and Cersei come in with the mountain. They sit down to try to participate in this conversation, but Kevin leads the group, the rest of them, out of the room to meet elsewhere.
What do you think of... So I watched the subtitles, and there's a parenthetical fart from Pycelle. But you did you hear it the second time?
Nope.
How did you miss the fart?
Nope, because I thought it was in the wrong place. I thought it was when he was walking past the mountain.
Oh,
No, it's when so I had already missed it
when he first double takes that. Oh my god, the mountain's behind me, isn't he?
Right.
I didn't care for that injection of humor into the proceedings.
It's so lowbrow.
It came on the heels of Tyrion bombing, which I've kind of come to appreciate more if they're doing what I think people are speculating they're doing there with the
right
the fish out of water thing. But yeah, that's pretty. I mean, he's just such a joke character at this point. And, like, that's the thing. Like, I like Lady Olenna. Like, the small council needs to get smaller. It needs to be just Kevin and Lady Olenna.
Right.
Because
Mace or whatever his
Mace
name is.
Mace Ty, he's a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
You know? And they need to get Grandmeister. But he hasn't been the same since they trimmed his beard. They just need to get both of them out of there. But we need a new Grandmeister.
Well, I don't know. I'm interested to see what Kevin does about all this, because clearly they are at odds now. Him and Cersei and Jaime are all working against each other at this point.
And the political situation is interesting because they're at an impasse. Like, you know, you can have your undead monster bash your brains in, but you can't make us stay and participate in this farce of a government.
Right.
Although, I will say that I also think what Cersei and Jaime were trying to get the council to deliberate on were things that are important. It's not like... I mean, Cersei's a little bit of like, oh, well, my honor's been insulted, blah, 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 and Olenna had a sick burn about, you know, you guys getting confused about who's family and who's fucking who and who's the real... But most of those things, especially Jaime, like, what are we going to do about Dorne? This is a fiasco.
Yeah, I think Jaime has more of a level head about this, honestly.
Yeah.
Despite having watched Myrcella die right.
Plus, he actually has a right to be there as Lord Commander.
Exactly, yeah.
That he asserts, but...
So, yeah, I wonder if he goes to this council and tries to be the mouthpiece for both himself and Cersei if they'll accept
him. We all know Cersei's crazy. But right. Come on, this is me.
Good. He'll play the good cop.
I do what needs to be done. Sometimes it's killing a king. Sometimes it's fucking my sister. But everyone knows that I'm the one that can be trusted. Yeah, I don't know. That sounds a less inspiring campaign slogan now that I'm working it through.
Fair enough. So we go over to Tommen, who is in the High Sparrow's chamber, or wherever he's praying. He's there to make demands, but...
The Great Sept of Baelor.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Okay. The Sparrow sits him down like a little boy, talks about God, atonement, and other such bullshit for the rest of the scene.
Which is interesting, because I wonder, now that I've seen this scene... once again, this is way past where we're at in the books. Baelor is kind of like the Constantine of the Faith of the Seven. Like he's the king that got way up in religion and it was super pious. How do you say it? Pious?
Pious, I think. Yeah.
Super pious. And he built this like giant sept to honor the Seven. And he instituted a lot of reforms to make the church more a vital part of the state. And I wonder if having this meeting in this is supposed to suggest that Tommen might go that route. They've already corrupted Lannister.
Right.
Now they got their clutches in Tommen. Because all the stuff that he's saying works because Tommen loves his mother, but he also knows that his mom, there's something off about her.
Right.
Don't you think? Like the fact he didn't like how she was trying to manipulate him against his wife. And, I think he believes a lot of things that Marjorie was saying about Cersei. So he's got some doubts about her.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that the stuff that the Sparrow was saying about trying to get the good out of everyone, that's something that he might be on board with. Like, I love my mom, but she could, she needs Jesus, essentially.
Right.
And maybe that's what she needs, the mother and the father and the warrior and the smith and all the others.
Yeah, I think Tommen is going to... I mean, it's a battle over Tommen at this point. Like, can the guilt and the love from his mother override this idea of Cersei needs to atone and the gods want it and, like, all of these things the High Sparrow is saying?
Sure.
Which one is going to win? And I think...
Who's going to win the battle of Tommen's soul? And
doesn't
matter.
The High Sparrow might have the better argument here. But, right, will it ultimately matter? Like, if Jaime decides, fuck it, I'm taking the mountain and we're going to kill this guy.
Yeah.
It might not matter.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because they mention his grandfather Tywin's statement about a good king listens to wise counsel, which is, if you recall back, another thing that Tywin said is any man that says... who has to say, I am the king, is no true king.
Right.
But Tommen starts off the confrontation with petulantly saying, I am the king. What does that mean to you? And the fact that the Sparrow was able to sit in his presence, like he's just completely grooming him to accept his power. That's the thing. Who wins the soul of Tommen and does it matter? Yeah. Because again, the thing that's like in the back of my mind as I'm watching all this King's Landing shit is this is a few cards under the main event,
Right.
So at the end, how does any of this matter? How does any of it matter? What is Martin playing at?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think it matters more to Cersei than it really matters to anyone else.
In which case, I don't give a shit because I don't really care. Cersei's pretty low on my give a shit about.
Sure. I mean, indirectly, it would also matter to Jaime,
okay,
I guess.
Now you're going up a few rungs of the ladder.
I'm trying to get you invested here. does it matter in any way to Tyrion? No.
No.
Shit.
No, probably not.
Okay. Well,
probably
I can't go
not.
There. I completely blank out during this scene. Like, he starts talking about atonement and God, and I'm just like,
sure.
Whatever, dude. I see what you're doing here, and the rest is just static, white noise. Like, I don't know what he said in this scene.
Yeah.
And I've watched it three times now. I couldn't tell you.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like,
I know what he's doing. I just don't know exactly how he did
it. And that's the point. Like, Tommen's so naive that he doesn't even realize he's being manipulated. In fact, likes the sound of a lot of this stuff.
He
came in one way and he got turned around.
Okay.
I'd like to see them help each other bring the goodness out of Cersei, though.
Okay.
That's like trying to squeeze the blood out of a stone.
Yeah. We go over to Arya doing her training montage. She's getting beat up. while she describes who Arya Stark was and her entire life. At the end, Jaqen takes her to the pool, gives her a drink, which returns her sight.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was nice that they had her get smacked when she said she had four brothers.
Sure.
She actually only has three.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even not three and a half. Who knows? Who knows?
What do you think about the... There's conspicuous mention of Walder Frey.
Mm-hmm.
There's conspicuous mention of clarification about the Hound's status.
Right.
I mean, that's...
She both wanted and didn't want to kill him.
Right. Well, and I don't know. I'm curious about what are all the implications of this. And also the fact that, like I mentioned, instant cast, that's still something that's even bigger question in my mind. Like, does this point... Is this... What... how am I trying to phrase this? What is the Faceless Man's deal? Are they like human lie detectors? Can they read minds? Is this poison magic? Is this science? Like,
right.
You know, clearly we've seen that fountain kill people.
Mm-hmm.
But have they been putting something in her food that where she's developed an immunity? And even if she's like, ha ha ha, I'm still Arya secretly in my heart. Does the poison kill her for that? Or is the poison going to do what the poison's going to do? And I, you know so much about the Faceless Men and their procedures that you just don't know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I get the feeling. It's definitely the same fountain that these people who died drank out of, right?
Yes, oh, sure.
So I do feel like it has a different effect depending on your attitude going in.
These guys have the magic faces, and they do sleight of hand, and like, right. So...
Sure, that's an argument that should absolutely appeal to me. Like, who the fuck knows? It's fantasy magic bullshit. Like,
sure. Like, maybe the poison's not in the fountain, maybe the poison's in the glass, and he just left it out this time.
Maybe the poison's in your heart. Who knows?
It's like Mags Bennett. The poison was in the glass the whole time. I don't know, but I'm very interested in what's going on here. And there's someone, someone's with a bomb-ass suggestion about where Arya is going in the feedback that I can't wait to get to.
I bet it has something to do with Needle.
No. You can shove Needle right up your ass, man, because it doesn't depend on that.
Well, I feel like maybe. That's still outstanding. Like, we need to know the status of Needle and the status of Arya as it relates to Needle. Okay. Right? Like, if they don't touch back on
Needle,
I'm going to cry.
Needle will reappear.
Okay.
Whether it's Jaqen, like, taunting her with it and throwing it in the ocean, or whether she goes back to get it after she decided these guys are full of shit. I don't know. But, yeah, there's no way we never see Needle again.
Just does the thing where he holds it too high for her to jump and reach.
Yeah.
That only worked for so long, Jaqen. Lord Umber comes to Ramsay, the young Lord Umber. What is his
John,
first
perhaps.
Name? Small John?
I
is
think
his name also
I think,
John?
Yeah, I think there's the Great and the Small John, which is like senior, junior. And I'm assuming, I don't think they mentioned it, but I'm assuming this is the Small John.
Yeah. He comes to Ramsay to ask for troops to hold off the wildlings who are coming from the north. Ramsay has one condition, pledge your banners to House Bolton. And, you know, essentially kiss my feet. Umber refuses. He's like, no, I'm not doing that. But I've got a gift for you instead, and it's that one wildling girl whose name I forgot.
Asha,
okay. And also, more importantly, Rickon Stark.
Yeah. Presents the head of his direwolf shaggy dog as proof.
Now, I mean, we've talked a lot about how a Stark lends legitimacy to House Bolton, right?
But that
certainly when there's a marriage alliance there of sorts... it's not exactly an alliance.
That's the thing, though, but Rickon is the rightful heir to Winterfell. So
right.
So with him coming back, like, it doesn't lend the kind of legitimacy. It's more like, this is a threat to your power. If I was the kind of guy that would stab you in the back, I would just wait for this guy to be a man full grown and come kick your ass out.
Right.
That is, I don't know. There's a lot of people disputing the authenticity of this direwolf. I feel like that is because they're like, oh, that head looks a little bit small to be a direwolf. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I think they'd make a much bigger deal out of that.
Yeah, I would feel cheated. I would feel bamboozled.
If it's average,
the head was too small, you should have picked up on that. No.
Not only that, but Ramsay. Like, Ramsay knows what a fucking wolf looks like.
And here's the thing. We have seen Rickon Stark. We know what he looks like. Ramsay doesn't mean we have to forget.
Right.
This is the same kid.
So how would the direwolf even be, even if it was fake, The important part is Rickon's here right. in mortal danger.
That's to prove the fact that he's Rickon to someone who doesn't know what Rickon looks like. Well, we know. So we know that it's that at the very least, they're telling us the truth about who this guy is.
Yeah, I mean, I...
So that'd be a stupid trick. That would be pointless.
I can't... Like, if the Umbers are doing some kind of double cross of the Boltons, I can't see it currently.
Okay.
Because it seems to me that there'd be a lot of northern people upset with the, you know, with the complete doing away with the Stark household, which is very respected and everybody loved them and they've been ruling for, you know, since they were kings of old. It seems hard to believe that all the younger generation would be like, fuck the Starks, but man, they're not giving me a lot to go on as far as seeing that they're, which if, you know. It just could be the normal Martin awfulness of the world, or it could be right. that he's got something up their sleeve that is going to be really awesome. I don't know.
Yeah, I just don't know how he's going to use him. But he seems happy to have found another Stark.
I do. I don't know. Is there anything significant in the fact that he is refusing to swear these oaths and the fact that he is being openly disrespectful? I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah,
there could be. This could be a ploy.
But on the other, they had easy answers for that. Like, well, your man was a man of honor and tradition. Your old man was a man of honor and tradition, and that didn't help Robb Stark, and ultimately didn't help him.
Right.
So, like, we're a new breed. Let's fuck all this kneeling and kissing rings and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fair argument. The other thing, maybe he knows what kind of man Ramsay is, and certainly if he knows that he killed his father, he thinks that he might kill Rickon Stark, right? Which might turn the rest of the North against him and give the Umbers the backing they need to roll into Winterfell and take Ramsay out.
Sure.
And maybe even help him make a case to the Wildlings when they come by. Hey, we're going to go do this thing in Winterfell with you.
Yeah.
Who knows? I'm interested to see where that goes, though, for sure. And finally, we get to Jon hanging his murderers, including Ollie and Alistair, in front of the rest of the brothers, and then he hands his Lord Commander cloak over to Ed, ending his watch.
Mm-hmm.
Officially. I really love this scene. I think...
There's a lot of nice touches.
Yeah. I mean, everything from, like, just going down the line and seeing what these people have to say for themselves. I thought Alistair's speech was great. I mean, that feels like Alistair to me.
Everyone stayed true to character, even yeah. Ollie. Like, Ollie yep. was filled with hate till the end, and for good reason. You know, these... Yeah. The guy who rode in to save John last episode is the man who murdered his family.
Yeah.
Right in front of him. So, like, and he thought him and John were bros about and were of one thought about the Wildlings, and and also, I thought the hanging itself was pretty brutal.
It was, yeah.
And then when John looked back over his shoulder and they're all kind of like, the way their eyes happen to be fixed are kind of, I thought, accusatory.
Uh-huh.
You know, something that you'd take with you.
Mm-hmm.
Those were a lot of great touches.
There were. Yeah, this is a great scene. And I feel like everybody got justice here.
Mm-hmm.
From John on down the line. So, I don't know. Maybe that's
the Oathbreaker thing, though, because my memory in the instant take was that John said, my watch has ended right to Ed, the new Lord Commander Apparent.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually kind of mutters it under his breath as he's walking away.
Yeah.
Which kind of sets up the maybe that there's going to be this Oathbreaker struggle. Also, where the fuck...
What do you mean struggle? Like, in his own head?
Well, just the fact that people will be like, how he feels no, like it? The fact that the Castle Black guys are like, this is bullshit. No, you can't leave.
Okay.
You know, now you're a traitor. Like, I mean, I don't know. That if they push that too far, it's going to be really fucking tedious.
Yeah. You should just be like, read the fucking words. Like,
yeah.
They're there
you
on
all
the page.
Said I was dead. I came back to life.
Right.
The words are what the words are, but yeah, I don't know. But also the fact that, you know, he that was kind of his parting words to no one. And also, right. Where does he go?
Well, I think it's more to show his intent. Like, I'm done yeah. with the Night's Watch.
Yeah.
To the audience. Like,
but he's the best man for the job.
Right. I think Ed could do a pretty good job. Ed's mm-hmm. not bad.
So what shit is he going to... I mean, that's the question we're all like, you know, what shit is he going to shovel next?
I think he's going to take Davos advice and start shoveling shit. Like, okay. get clean up all the shit in Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
He's gonna go south. He's gonna reclaim Winterfell or try to. Like, who knows exactly how that's gonna go.
I mean, but having I think that's the Wildlings, if this wasn't just a setup to Tormund's dick joke, having the Wildlings yeah. worshiping him as a god probably is not a bad deal.
No, not at all. I do feel a little bit like I wanted more to do about this idea that Jon Snow is dead up in the north and everyone still thinks he's alive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that might come back in some form,
yeah.
But it certainly didn't hit in the way that I expected it to.
Yeah, and the other thing is that we pretty much got conclusive proof that, you know, Jon hasn't changed materially.
Yeah.
Like, there might be some subtle changes, but it's almost like any transformative experience. This is not a uniquely transformative experience that he's going to have, like, a piece of his soul missing.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe they could hint at that later on. But
maybe
he
can't remember his house words or something. Like, something very specific.
Winter is frequently delayed. Wasn't that what we said? Winter seems to just really drag its feet. Maybe it was summer. I don't know. But it does seem like he's just John. He's the same John. Like, he's like, what the fuck happened? But that's what anybody's experience would be coming back from the dead.
Right, right. And they make a point of, in the inside Game of Thrones thing, the Double D's talk about how this is a completely unique experience, right? No one in our world has ever experienced being murdered and coming back from the dead. I would almost want to argue with that,
mm-hmm.
And say that people do frequently clinically die,
mm-hmm.
and come back. But yeah, it's something certainly that he has to work through.
Mm-hmm.
And how that manifests itself, I don't know, but it'll be interesting, I think.
I thought visually it was interesting when, you know, he's coming back to life and he's having all these shocking revelations. And he looks down and he sees these gaping wounds in his body.
Right.
What's the implication of that? Because, you know, I've seen Beric get his head stove in, mm-hmm. and be ran through and he comes right back to life. Like, what's going on biologically there?
Fucked if I know, man. Magic.
I mean, if you still got a hole in your, I mean, is his heart pumping? Has he got a 98.6 body temperature?
That's a good question. Maybe that's why his Johnson's so small. He's gone cold. It's all shriveled up.
No blood flow.
Right?
No blood flow.
Yeah.
He
should have tried to defend himself a little harder. I mean, like,
it's one of those things,
on,
like,
Tormund,
do you want to be the man
here
to protest too much?
Right. Right.
Like, it's like, yeah, whatever. We both know what's up.
I don't know. So to me, like, him seeing those wounds is like confirmation. Oh, this wasn't a dream. This wasn't something that happened to me that, you know,
did they still
kill me.
Hurt?
I doubt it.
They weren't bleeding. I mean, that's
right.
They look like they should, but they weren't bleeding.
Yeah. It doesn't look like they're going to heal either. I don't think they're going to, like, scab over and just be scars later.
Hmm.
I think they're always going to look like that.
All right.
But who knows? And that's pretty much it.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
This week's podcast is sponsored by the good folks at Casper, and I'm here to tell you about their mattresses and how you can get one online. And you're probably saying, Aaron, an online mattress, you say. How can I possibly judge its quality by not going and laying on it for a few seconds at a store? And I'll say, they actually will drop ship this sucker to you, and they give you 100 days risk-free trial that you can try it out. And if you're not happy, they got a free and painless return system. And these I think you're gonna like this mattress because I replaced a fairly new king size bed I had with one that they gave me as a review, and I still have. And I find that it's one of these hybrid mattresses that has a blend of latex and memory foam. It's not as stiff and hard as some of the other memory foam mattresses that I've laid on for a few seconds at a retail establishment. But I find it incredibly comfortable, and it was a huge upgrade over my old bed, which again, wasn't exactly a worn out spring shoving me in the skin. It was just, a couple year old mattress. And the pricing is really attractive too. This is an obsessively engineered product at a shockingly fair price, $500 for a twin, up to $950 for a king size mattress. And we could actually help you out a little on that. If you go to casper.com/baldmove and use the promo code baldmove during checkout, all one word, you can get $50 off that order. And again, what other place can you buy a mattress and try it for up to 100 nights and be like, meh, it's not for me? It really gives you the confidence to try that. If you're in the market for a mattress, I definitely urge you to give it a try. It's so easy to get it. Like, I couldn't believe this king size mattress came in like a 2x2x3 box that was about 50-60 pounds. Much easier to lug up my apartment stairs than it was my king size when I first got it.
Yeah.
So I think people should try it. If you're in a market for a mattress, not getting the quality of sleep that you're looking for, go to casper.com/baldmove, enter the promo code baldmove at checkout to get $50 off. Terms and conditions, of course, apply. Try it out today. This podcast also sponsored by us at baldmove.com. You can join a club at club.baldmove.com. You know, Jim and I bust our butts to produce these free podcasts day in, day out, year after year, week after week, month after month, second by second, day by day. And we are entirely supported by we have a few ads here and there, but well over 2/3 of our income comes from listener engagement and support. You go to club.baldmove.com for as little as $1 a month. You get tons of extra content, video access to our feeds. Like if you're jonesing for the instant take, if you're like all a Twitter and you can't get on Twitter or Facebook's too boring, after the airing, we're up with within 5 or 10 minutes airing our instant cast, and it's the quickest way you can get that by joining up the club and watching us record it in our studio. Again, tons of extra bonus features for as little as $1 a month, and it helps support our independent podcast and helps us keep churning out the content that you enjoy so much. So if you do like us, please check out the club, club.baldmove.com, and thank you in advance. We have a lot of feedback. If you would like to send in feedback, of course, you can always do so through GameOfThrones@baldmove.com or get on the forums, forums.baldmove.com. If you want to talk about spoilers, please just keep it to the appropriately marked spoiler threads. Let's start. First off, Alex K. had something that I wondered about, I think we both wondered about the crowns and whether they were like reforged or different each time. He sent in an image of both Robert, Joffrey, and Tommen's, and they're, surprise, surprise, all different.
Huh.
Robert had like really big, fat, almost elk kind of horns on it. And I think Joffrey's the most like delicate in the way the things were working, and Tommen's got a little bit more of a sturdier base to it. But it does seem like they're just making new ones each king.
Okay.
Maybe that's like a tradition that they cast a new crown for every new king.
I guess so.
I don't know. But no, it's visually different for all three of them. So they just made Tommen a crown that happens to make him look like a pointy-headed doofus. It's the only thing I can explain. Tyson S. said, in Season 1, Ned Stark says to Robert Baratheon, "The narrow sea still lies between us. All fear the Dothraki the day they teach their horses to run on water. If winter's ever going to be a major force in story, it could show up and freeze the narrow sea and allow the Dothraki horses to walk across it. With the Dothraki back in the story and the ships and marine destroyed, if Daenerys is going to take an army to Westeros, they might have to walk. Can you see this happening? Related, has it been established how far south the White Walkers can go? Do they need a winter climate to live?" This is something we've talked about in, like, I think we came up in the spoiler cast last week, but this is not in itself a spoiler. What brings the extreme cold weather seems to be the White Walkers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's that kind of, like, when they come, like, the cold follows them. So, and it's one of those things where you can't just go across the narrow sea and be safe. It's like, you know, this thing is going to eventually encircle the globe if you don't stop it. So, as a practical matter, I suppose the sea could freeze, but the Dothraki don't seem very well equipped to deal with the cold.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, their mankinis are not going to handle freezing cold temperatures very well.
No, not at all.
Plus, it seems like a shit show to have thousands and thousands of screaming Dothraki sprinting across sheets of ice. I don't know.
Yeah, and, you know, we go up to Hardhome, the water isn't frozen into ice there.
That's true.
And there were White Walkers everywhere.
Yeah.
So I don't know how long it would take the ocean to freeze. I don't know what the time frame looks
like. I mean,
because
you're talking about, like, the last, like, great winter, you know, talked about it, like, spanned, you know, it was long time, like, even maybe spanning generations. So if something like that happens, then, you know, maybe. But I don't think it's going to happen in a show span. And also, the Dothraki don't have cold weather gear. Chelsea C. has a theory that she's passing on to her friend B-Rad. When Dany goes to Vaes Dothrak, they think that Drogon will follow. At some point, he will land and perch atop the twin horse statues as a visual proclamation that he's the stallion that mounts the world, which is what will fully rally the Dothraki to her cause. I don't usually read, like, the more fanfiction-y theories, but the fact that they always show that horse thing pretty prominently, and that the Dothraki seem like they're a spiritual, superstitious people, I don't know. Do you think that could do it?
If he climbs up there and rides those horses?
It just fucks the shit out of the statues. Like, literally just, like, you know, humps them. Can Drogon still look scary and awesome if he's humping, you know, ceramic horses?
Sure, he can.
Because the other thing is, like, I mean, Drogon's has to come and set fire to the whole thing because Dany needs these guys.
Yeah, I think she does.
Especially now that it seems like... she's got to reconquer the other slave cities too, right?
Right.
And they just pointed out the fact that she doesn't have enough troops for that. So I don't know. There's got to be something that's more symbolic, spiritual, visual. It's not going to be just Drogon setting fire to everything and freeing her. So it's got to be something like that. I thought it was interesting. Rachel S. said, "Did you guys notice when Melisandre tries to bring back Jon, she starts with the same ritual that Arya is taught in the House of Black and White. She cleans the body, trims his hair and beard, then washes the hair. The camera angles are the same as well. Sure, Melisandre throws in some hair into the fire and chants a bit, but the basic rituals are the same. Right before the scene, Davos says to Melisandre, 'I'm not a devout man, obviously. Seven gods, drowned gods, tree gods, it's all the same to me.' And yeah, in context, Davos is saying this in a dismissive way, but it may be more true than he realizes. It would be interesting if all the central religions in this universe ended up being derivations of the same ancient religion. Haven't heard anyone talking about this, so I was hoping to get your thoughts."
You probably know a thing or two about the religions in this world, yeah?
I mean, the Faceless Men assert that to be true, that all the gods are essentially an aspect of the one true god, which is death. And as an atheist, that kind of interests me that there is some central, like, whatever power or magic is in this world, it's not going to be the result of several different gods. It's probably going to be some physical thing that either people are interpreting as a god or maybe it does have an intelligence. So I've always liked that idea. And, you know, again, if you're a Faceless Man devotee, that's just your religion, man. That's in the Bible.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know what this means for the story, though. Like, is this going to be like the Faith of the Seven have kind of like been the ascendant religion except for the North in all of Westeros? Is this going to be the Lord of the Light? Are we seeing like a religious revolution as well here?
It could be, yeah.
That they sweep out the Seven and the Northern gods and replace it with the One True. I don't know. What does that even mean in this world? Brandon T said, "You mentioned that Brienne You mentioned that Brienne may not have known who the Hound was when we were trying to explain why she wouldn't tell Arya or Sansa about, you know, who Arya was last seen with. But I'm pretty certain that Pod mentioned that he was Sandor before the fight, and you are correct, Podrick. He who knows all banners and all customs was able to quickly spot, the former Kingsguard and inform Brienne of that. So." I guess the question's still on the table. Why was Brienne not telling Sansa the whole truth about how she left things with Arya? She doesn't want to worry her?
That's a good question. I don't know, because clearly they weren't fighting each other, right? Like, Arya and the Hound were seemingly on decent terms.
But on the other hand, it could be that Brienne, I threw this guy's ass off a cliff.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure maybe she just assumed he was dead, and why would you...
Like I do.
Yeah, why would you add extra irrelevant information when this was clearly like them just kind of exchanging data?
Yeah.
You know, this was not like a comprehensive debriefing. This is, hey, we're taking the time to set up, you know, to warm ourselves before we keep marching. I don't know. I don't have the answer, but it certainly seems like it's an open question to some extent. Joe from Maine, just finishing the season 6, episode 2. Before the third episode, and I had a thought. Could the Red Woman's prophecies or spells not come to fruition until the previous one has been completed? She had her false visions last season with Stannis, but maybe that's because the leech burning for Joffrey, Robb, and Baelon hadn't been completed. Then once Baelon dies, she unknowingly is back to her true self. So, if you recall, she used the leeches that she put on Gendry's chest as a way to throw them on the fire, and then she named each false... Well, I think Stannis named each false king. Essentially, that there's some kind of loophole that you can't have true prophecies or other spells until the previous one is complete. In which case, okay. I'd be like, well, why is a red god sitting with a thumb up his ass waiting for Baelon to die? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if this is a spell, you would want it to work with like some kind of efficacy, not like, oh, 2 years later, it finally got around to completing. That's my objection to that. What do you
think?
Well,
I mean, I think the show has told us why this worked in this moment. Because like Boros or Thoros or whatever his name is, Amir,
mm-hmm.
the International Space Station guy, he was at his low point, right?
Yeah.
And like he had had everything stripped away.
He's full of mold. He's lost attitude control.
Right. Just set fire to the cockpit. Maintain.
Yeah, yeah.
It was all bad.
Yep.
The habitat ring was gone.
It's really a low point.
It was. It was the lowest of points. And
starting to experience atmosphere and drag, he got so low.
The same with Melisandre in this moment. She had feared that all of her predictions were false. And
yeah.
That she had no information that anybody else didn't have. And it was like, that's the thing that did it. And I feel like if the show were trying to say something else about this, like give us a hint as to why the prophecies would work in certain instances, they would tell us. And I feel like they did in saying that she was real low.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's mostly right. And as he mentions in his emails, like, it's too much of a coincidence for me, but it could just be a coincidence.
I suppose so.
Yeah. I mean, life's full of them.
Yeah.
Like, Danny just happens to be in the middle of the Dothraki capital when they're all going to come up for the Super Bowl. Like, working out nicely if she's wanting to make off with a lot of Dothraki riders.
Right.
Dominic P. says, "I don't buy for a second that the situation with the Umbers and the Boltons is not a ruse. The wilding woman Asha would have killed herself before letting her and Rickon be caught. You don't waltz in as a lord saying your dad was a cunt and then say, here's a gift. Also, that didn't look like a direwolf head to me." I'm going to have to stop you there, Dominic, because unfortunately got served a slice of very, very dry pie.
Mm-hmm.
No amount of wine is going to wash it down, and just going to have to move on. there's, yeah, I mean, we got nothing more to say about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it could certainly be a ploy.
Yeah. I will say that if it turns out that that's a small dire wolf head, I kind of pissed.
Yeah.
That's dirty pool.
That's absurd.
Yeah. Rick S. An idea for Arya's plot. Jon is now an obvious target for the Faceless Men. They make a big deal out of needing to make sure death gets his due, so Jon being resurrected is an absolute affront to that.
Huh.
I think that once Arya is truly no one, they're going to send her to correct this imbalance, which leads to her settling the internal conflict if she is no one for Arya.
All right.
Or no one or Arya.
I like it.
That's an awesome idea. Mm-hmm. And that's just the kind of thing that would make her be like, fuck this bullshit.
I think so, yeah.
But it also, like, I am almost taking this as canon because, yeah, someone coming back from the dead would certainly piss these guys off.
Yep.
So, I don't know. You might be onto something there, Rick. Miguel C. said, there's a small, perhaps nitpicky question I have. They referred to the undead mountain as Sir Gregor and straight up as Clegane. Mm-hmm. I thought they were being more subtle about it and calling him Robert Strong. Did I miss something?
Nope, they're the same guy.
Well, no, but I mean, the fact that they're abandoning the ruse that this is Sir Robert Strong.
It's with Qyburn, right? Like, Qyburn fucking knows. He's the guy who brought him back.
But even the small council is saying, like, this business with them bringing back Clegane, we didn't sanction this experience, and it's an abomination.
Right, right.
That's true. Like, in the epilogue to Dance of Dragons, they kind of show that there's been whispers of the abomination, and, like, because people aren't stupid.
Right. He's the biggest man in Westeros. Like,
yeah.
You're going to know.
Yeah. And he happens to have a full face mask that no one can see into. And yeah. No, I actually like it this way because it actually makes the small council and people seem the intelligent, cunning people that we, well, I don't know about Fartmeister Picel, but yeah, it gives them a good solid head under shoulders.
Yeah.
Unlike Gregor. Mm-hmm. He's probably got some hollow head on his shoulders. But no, I don't think you've missed anything. They're just like, there's no need to have this ruse with the people that are in the small council. Robert R. regarding Tyrion being a dick. I honestly read everything Tyrion is doing as being required to, right? Dry pie. Jim completely served you a big old slice of it.
Taste it.
Yep. I'm actually going to let him wash it down for some wine because he ends it up with saying that this is going to set up a central conflict where Dany will be faced with following Tyrion's advice or siding with longtime loyalists who don't think highly of Tyrion and his situation at some point. Are they setting something to where Tyrion's going to be like, look, you got to trust me, this is the thing to do, and Missandei and Grey Worm is like, you know, it's Varys and Tyrion versus Missandei and Grey Worm. They've had her back forever, but they're not also, I don't think they're the most strategic thinkers.
Right.
Is there going to be something where Dany's going to have to make a choice between her longtime loyalist and the cunning newcomers?
Could be, yeah.
I think that's an interesting conflict.
It is, and I don't think she entirely trusts Tyrion yet, right? I mean, has plenty of reasons not to, so I think there could be a little bit of doubt about what Tyrion's telling her, and that could play into it, too.
I mean, I don't know. Assuming she comes back, and Tyrion and Varys have kind of righted the ship of state.
Yeah.
If you were waiting to betray her, the time when she's out of the city and has no power would be the perfect time to spring your trap, you know?
What if they don't want to relinquish power once she gets back?
Ooh.
She has to dragon up or something.
I don't. Do you see Tyrion doing
I don't see
that?
It. No, I don't see it happening.
Because he just doesn't have the claim, you know?
Right.
Like, he can be the power behind the power, but he can't be the power.
Yeah. They still are keeping up this ruse that Daenerys is on vacation, sleeping, like,
yeah,
who knows where she is, but she'll be back, and don't think about it.
Brent J. Am I the only one that's wondering when the bomb is going to drop about Shireen? Davos apparently still doesn't know, and I'm really curious about how it will affect him. Your thoughts? So this is a fact that Davos doesn't necessarily know that Melisandre was complicit in her death. I think the assumption is that Shireen got killed with the rest of the camp, mm-hmm. and that Melisandre was the lone survivor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you think that at this point, I don't know, because it seems like that would bother him. But also, maybe he knows it already.
Yeah, I mean, it would bother him. How much would it bother him?
He's very pragmatic, this guy.
What does it change?
Yeah,
because she would have been killed anyway.
Right.
Right? I mean, unless she would have just been taken by Ramsay, and mm-hmm. maybe that's even worse. I don't know. I don't know. Of what importance is it at this point to Davos? I know he would not like it, certainly, but would he do anything about it?
I don't know. Melisandre seems like her character's kind of spinning her wheels. Like, her sole purpose in life was to bring Jon Snow back from the dead.
Yeah.
So I could totally see him just going berserk and killing her, because what else? What does she do from here on out?
Yeah, maybe so.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't know, because he's also... The one defining trait about him seems like he's very pragmatic, and he wants what's best by the realm, and if what's best by the realm is not pursue his petty revenge against Melisandre. I mean, he already blames her for the death of his sons.
And he wanted to have her killed a while back. He asked Stannis to do it, but Stannis wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, it'd make him more sad and resigned, but I don't necessarily think it would send him to a bloodthirsty rage. But... I can totally see it that way, too.
Maybe. She taught him to read. She taught him to read.
Yes.
Does that mean nothing to you?
What do you call that? The opposite of not being
illiteracy?
Able to read. Literacy. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're illiterate.
That's not a good word to struggle to find.
Your illiterate co-host is having some trouble with his...
Maybe the only worst word would be vocabulary. It's a what? It's a V. It's a...
Yeah, it's something about the words. I don't know. Words are wind. Rob from San Jose has some problems. Jon Snow was stabbed by 6, including Ollie, but they only hung 4. Even if you assume the archer killed by 1-1 was number 5, someone has escaped.
Yeah.
And also, if you look at the scene on film, there's like another half dozen people kind of watching.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is this significant? Is there going to be some kind of anti-John faction within Castle Black, or did his resurrection sweep all that under the rug?
The only way that might matter is if they come after Ed. Like, I don't think John's hanging around Castle Black for any longer than he needs to.
Okay.
He's going to grab a canteen and go.
So how, on a scale of 1 to fuck this shit, how frustrated are you going to be if John leaves... And literally Sansa shows up in the next episode and like, where's my brother at?
Fairly frustrated. I mean, it's a series of near misses.
Yeah.
Across the board for the Starks. Sure. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm not as fed up with it as a lot of people are, because I was reading a lot on that.
Mm.
But it'll feel a little cheap.
Yeah, I don't know. It is interesting that they only hung the 4.
Yeah.
Because that is a little bit of a plot hole. Why wouldn't John want to hang everyone that murdered him?
Right, and that was my first thought when he had 4 up there. I'm like,
do you think there were a lot more? Do you think they lost track?
The people making the show, or
like that's
John?
That's the thing that bothers me. That if they do this and don't address it, it's a continuity error.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
I don't like easily. It's like I'm not a book purist, but if you're telling me a story, I do expect you to tell it fucking right.
Yeah.
And a little detail like that, like having 6 guys stab and 4 guys swing, bothers me.
Right.
Because it implies that there's a certain lack of care and consideration. It's not, I'm not adapting a book detail. Now I'm not getting the damn details straight in my own story. I don't like that.
Right.
I don't like that.
That maybe John either didn't know the other people exactly, but he knew it was Ollie. So like in that final stab.
Sure.
In that moment, he was clear-headed enough to realize he was stabbing him. So, it didn't make any sense to me.
I kind of hope they address it.
Yeah.
But if they don't, I guess this is going to be one of the disappointments of the show. He also, Rob from San Jose, wants to know if he's the only one thinking that Varys is going to dump the 2 bodies overboard, recover the silver after the woman was having fled because she squealed. So we talked about whether she'll die, like, just because of Sons of Harpies. What about Varys doing it?
Maybe.
Bad spycraft.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want word getting out about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's, like, because the only thing you have as a spy master is your word. Like, if you tell your, you know, the people you're handling one thing and you don't do right by them, then that word, if it gets out, then you're screwed. Because otherwise, you know, spies are dirty, skulking, underhanded creatures. They're all about betrayals.
Yeah.
But you just can't be, if they ever think that the people that you're trying to deal with have to believe that the one person that you won't betray is them. Because if not, why the hell would they work with you?
Maybe he'll bring her back to Marine and start going to EST meetings with her. Like a certain spy I know.
Yeah. yeah. No, to me, that's a Joffrey or Ramsay play. That's not a Savvy play. So we'll see. She might very well die, but I don't think it's going to be by his hand.
Okay.
Julia from Sweden. I think that what Jaqen did to Arya was much more of a mind game than something that would actually kill her. He said that if a girl really is no one, that she would have nothing to fear from drinking it. If she doesn't drink it, it's clear that she really was no one, but if she drinks it, he knows that she really believes that she is. I think that the potion she drank would have given her sight back no matter what.
Okay.
So that's more of like, this isn't a metaphysical test, this is just an antidote that's being administered somehow.
So do they fill up the entire fucking pool? It might just be water. You're right. It might just be water and the cup has the poison. Maybe,
or the healings in the glass. I don't know, but I think that she's kind of onto something here. Because who drinks the poison and says, "Muhahaha, I'm cheating the god of death," as they're chugging this poison? And even if you are thinking that, I think that that would fuck to you to an extent that, like, well, shit. Maybe I am no one because this didn't kill me. Like, there's a lot of different ways it can go. Let's see. Matt S. Does John saying he experienced nothing confirm that he didn't warg into ghost? Matt S. with the big questions. Right?
Okay.
That's pretty perceptive because we talked a great length about how the way they brought back John leaves rooms for many, many interpretations. But mm-hmm. him saying, what do you remember while you were dead? Nothing. Not, well, I sniffed myself. I licked myself.
Right.
I got hungry when
saw my own body on a table.
Yeah, that is pretty conclusive proof that he didn't warg into ghost.
Right. As long as you believe John is being truthful here.
And I have
which
seen
I
no
do.
Reason why he would lie in this particular situation.
Yeah.
With the shock of him being dead and... Yeah, no, so like, okay. R.I.P. ghost as refrigerator for John's consciousness.
I think so. I think it's official.
Yep. Nice catch, Matt.
Yeah.
Daniel S. says, on your instant take, you were asking about other instances besides Jon Snow of characters breaking oaths. I think an argument can be made that virtually every episode segment explored some character violating some oath or obligation.
Okay, run them down and justify it.
Here we go. The Boltons broke their oath to the Starks. Daenerys violated her obligation as a Khaleesi widow to live amongst other widows. The flashback showed a young Ned Stark mopping up the murder of the Mad King, which presumably violated Ned's oath to his king, plus his oath not to stab fuckers in the back. Samuel broke his promise to his wildling girlfriend that they would always stay together. As he told her on the ship, he's going to drop her off with his family instead. Even the scene with Arya Stark, there's still a hint that she's totally not on board with the Faceless Man and may return to her old identity one day if given the chance, particularly if she's reunited with their siblings, alluding to Needle, etc. Okay. From a certain Obi-Wan Kenobi point of view, everyone's breaking their oaths.
Right. Like, I have no idea what that oath about Ned and his king is. No fucking clue. Like, why would killing some dudes...
Well, Ned at that point would be the Warden of the North, so he swore to uphold the king's law and his rule. So by the act of rebellion, you've broken your oaths of fealty to the crown.
What rebellion is he participating in? I don't get what's going on here well enough.
So the Mad King was the Mad King, and he did a lot of bad things, and Ned and Robert Baratheon rebelled against him. This is like the final battle in this war. If you didn't...
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was the same moment in time here.
No. So, like, what happened is, just to give everyone a rundown, is, you know, as Littlefinger told us last year, Lyanna Stark got crowned by Rhaegar Targaryen, the Queen of Love and Beauty, at this tournament at Harrenhal, which is very shocking, since he had a wife that he rode right past to give her this honor.
Right.
Shortly afterwards, he apparently abducted Lyanna and drug her off to this tower. Ned's father and eldest brother, Brandon Rickon, went to the Mad King to demand justice. Mad King set them on fire. This was a further shock to the sensibilities, and John Arryn, the Warden of the East, or the Warden of the Vale, whatever, took his banners and Robb Baratheon and Ned Stark, and they took all their bannermen and went to war. And that ultimately led to Jaime killing the Mad King right before his father invaded King's Landing. It also led to Rhaegar Targaryen being killed on the Trident, which is the big river that cuts through Westeros. And which led to the central question of why were the Kingsguard down guarding this tower instead of being with their prince or their king, which they enigmatically answered, this is where our prince wanted us.
Okay.
Clearly, is not a spoiler that there's more to come with this whole Tower of Joy.
Right, right.
And also, you know, I don't know. I kind of have an idea, but I don't know.
Okay. So the oath that he took would have been loyalty to
the king,
the Targaryen king.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And he broke that by rebelling with Robert.
Yeah.
All right. Gotcha.
Because 300 years ago when the Targaryens, it used to be seven, they call it the Seven Kingdoms because they used to have seven kings that would, you know, go to war with each other. But the Targaryens came and conquered them all. And except for Dorne, they're the exception. And everyone had to bow. Had to bend the knee to the rightful, and then all the kings, the old kings, got converted into wardens. Okay. They're like the administrators that all paid tribute to the king. Mm-hmm. All right, hopefully that's not too confusing. We can talk more about it in the spoiler section if y'all like, which will be a lively and eventful one this week. Sam L. from DC, what was up with Ned's sword outside the Tower of Joy? There's no way that was ice, the Stark family greatsword.
No.
In the books and the show, ice is this enormous two-handed sword, much bigger than Longclaw, but outside the Tower of Joy, young Ned is swinging this little thing around one-handed like it was a toy.
Yeah, Ned's not rocking ice in those scenes. I mean, Ned doesn't rock ice for the most part. He has this long sword, right? Not like this great sword.
Yeah, he didn't ride to King's Landing with
it. He whips that out to cut off heads.
That's a ceremonial family heirloom. It's not like a battle sword. Now, yeah.
He does have the same longsword in those young Ned scenes as he has in old Ned.
Very
from
nice
season
prop.
One.
Very nice prop consistency, which makes me crazy that there's not more guys swinging from the gallows.
Yeah.
But there are a ton of Renaissance fair types that will tell you that in fact great swords are perfectly valuable, viable weapons on the battlefield. Whatever. Ned disagrees. In fact, George Martin's commented on the fact that, no, that's just a ceremonial blade. They wouldn't whip it out for battle. So you might be right. On the other hand,
unless you're the mountain, it seems too heavy.
Sure, sure.
It seems too unwieldy.
Again, there's lots of guys be like, nah, man, I fought with a 50-pound blade on the lawns of, Renfe. I'm not disparaging because of that. And I don't know. I'm not a medieval combat expert. I'm just saying that both Martin and Ned Stark disagree with you. So
I doubt they were fighting Sir Arthur Dayne. Like, you gotta.
Yeah. He might cut you to ribbons if you got this, maybe it's.
Dario knows why you don't fight with a great sword.
Sure.
He knows.
Sure. And again, it's not an interesting argument for me because both the guy who created the series and the in-universe guy himself think that it's not the way to go. So that's good enough for me. Eric B. said, hey guys, quick question. When John came out to meet the man in the Night's Watch after his resurrection, the men of the Night's Watch, rather, Tormund approached John, talked about his short claw. Then John moved past Tormund and on to Ed, where the two embraced. To me, it seemed like John was cold to Tormund. At least unfamiliar with him, especially since as John walked past Tormund towards Ed, the look on Tormund's face seemed like he was taken aback by John's indifference, especially considering all they had been through together, and especially how warm he was with Ed. Did John just snub Tormund? Now, my first thought was, what the fuck? Get out of here. But then I got like five more emails asserting the same thing. I did not see any of that.
So there's a dick joke right up front about how tiny his pecker is. He probably didn't take too kindly to that. Although, it was a joke.
It's a ball busting.
It is. But he's still in shock, right? Like, he's very much still in shock. And I didn't feel like he popped out of it until he hugged Ed, and Ed was like, are you? Like, your eyes haven't changed.
Sure.
How do I know you're still there? And then he had, like, this moment where he chuckled.
Yeah.
And he kind of snapped out of his shock a little bit.
You know, if Ed starts with the ball busting, maybe they don't engage on that level, but I thought it's like, they've both been through some shit, but John has been through, they became black brothers together. I think there's implied, and I don't know if the show has done a great job of showing how close John was to his friends, but to me it seemed like that he would be more affectionate in a masculine way with Ed than he would with Tormund. Like, they just have a different relationship.
Sure.
Tormund respects them, and they have admiration, but I don't think there's love there.
Yeah.
In the same way that, like, you know, him and Ed are brothers in a kind of fraternal bond.
You should see how he thanked 1-1.
It didn't involve Short Claw. Let's continue. Daniel S. says, I'm sure this is not the only person whose mind has crossed, but do you think there's more to when Jon Snow took off his Lord Commander cloak and gave it to Dolores Ed?
More to it?
I think he was handing control over to Ed, but I think that but everyone else there was wearing a heavy winter coat, and yet Jon walked out wearing just his normal clothes, as though maybe he doesn't feel the cold anymore.
Okay.
It could be a coinkydink, but it would also be cool if this was some remnant of coming back from the dead. Or maybe he's now more like Melisandre and doesn't feel the need for a coat because he doesn't feel the cold.
Right. I could see that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I didn't catch that, but it would be kind of cool that would be a little bit of a change to Jon, that maybe even that what little remained of her power, her Lord of the Light power, has passed to Jon. Of course, she didn't instantly turn into an old woman again.
Right.
And that's the other thing. That's another thing floating out in the back of my head, that there's still something to that reveal.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess...
Aside from just how low she is.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it still works that as just, like, just the plain text reading of it. But I guess I'm looking for something else, too. Why reveal that if... because it's not like Carice is a terrible actress that can't portray a person who's beat down and who's under a bunch of heavy blankets. I think there's more to it, but I guess I wouldn't be outraged if there isn't. Megan H. said, was it just me or did the waif have a reaction when Arya mentioned Walder Frey's name? Perhaps a connection there that could somehow maybe help Arya back into the game in Westeros, though I suppose that would be very unknown of her. Of the waif showing, betraying this reaction. Both of these emails might be in the department, like the Tormund being snubbed and the Jon no coat and the waif's reaction. These might all be from the department of reading too much into it, but
yeah.
Again, I don't know, because I actually watched this again and there's something, but it also seems like the waif just kind of likes fucking with Arya, so that might just be part of her portrayal. I don't know. It's more like, oh, Walder Frey, eh? Oh, we got designs for him. I don't know. That wasn't in my subtitles.
Yeah. Well, she certainly got a reaction when she bashed her with the staff.
I think it's because you heard Arya's fart in that scene, right?
I did, yeah.
I mean, that was the reaction just, right there.
Three of them, right? Sequential, just real.
Quick successions. Just like, you know, that means that the others are coming, I think. One fart when the brothers are coming back, right. Two farts if it's the wildlings, and three, haven't heard those farts in some time. Steve from Florida says, why do you think we haven't seen Drogon? If his quote-unquote mother has been kidnapped and forced to march, is the dragon just biding its time until there are less Dothraki around for her to swoop on? He didn't seem to mind swooping into Marines' fighting pits to save her. Is he hibernating or what?
I really don't know.
No one knows.
He's just doing his own thing, maybe.
Tyrion introduced this idea that the mind of a dragon is this intelligent, inscrutable thing, so he could have some cunning. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's waiting for an awesome perch like the two horses to get his groove on. I don't know. Maybe she has to consciously call him. Or there's some speculation in the from the books that the reason Drogon showed up at the fighting pit is not because he had loyalty for Dany, but like, hey, there's fire and blood. I'm a dragon. I like that kind of shit. It's time for me to get my eat on.
Could be.
So I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah, I think that idea of how much control she actually has over these dragons is still very much in the air.
Yes. Matt B. said, I was really enjoying Bran's vision. You wanting to make a dragon in the air joke?
Nope.
Yeah, you were.
Nope.
Yeah, it was right there.
You saw it?
It was right there.
It was. I'm sorry.
Speaking of,
I apologize for the
reactions.
Joke I didn't make.
Well, you miss 90% of the jokes you don't make, John.
That's true.
John? Jim?
John? Just change my name to John. John Boy? Jones.
Jesus. Matt B. says, I was really enjoying Bran's vision up until the moment when he yelled at Ned Stark and he turned around as if he heard something. This moment sent a chill down my spine and instilled terror into my heart. I am terrified at the prospect of the introduction of time travel into Game of Thrones.
Right.
The show is already complicated enough and has enough issues with time, such as Gilly's never-aging baby, as it is. Time travel is really difficult to execute well and really easy to mess up in television and cinema. If Bran is able to go back in time and alter the path of the future, I will lose my shit. And 20 years from now, the idiom jump the shark will be replaced with talk to Ned. Is he right to have this fear that there could be some... paradoxes and time travel and weird shit.
Absolutely. Time travel is, if you are just making a time travel show, that's hard enough to do when you've got all this other shit in there. Like, and also, the thing I don't like about it, and I wouldn't like about it if they introduced time travel and affecting the past to affect the outcome of the future, I wouldn't like how irrelevant it makes everything else. Because ultimately, why show me six seasons of something if Bran is just going to change it all in a single vision?
That's a good point, because in time travel fiction, like The Terminator and whatnot, that's kind of the point. That's the central struggle.
Right.
This, it's like, this is not a story about time travel. If you introduce time travel, it kind of makes everything else be like, well...
Especially this late.
Yeah, like, Bran could just think hard enough and make things different.
Exactly. It makes all the other struggles irrelevant.
Having said that, science fiction and time travel is kind of my jam. If it's done really well and subtly, with some maybe like the fact that like the, you know, the three-eyed raven asserts that the history's been written, you can't, like, maybe Bran thinks he can do it, but that's a false promise that ends up that even if he changed something, it, you know, time's arrow keeps everything on track, and it's, you know,
and this could be his Luke in the swamps moment. Where he says, I need to change this
failure,
and he tries, and he goes off the path to try to change it, but he can't.
Yeah.
And so, you know, his leaving, you know, his quest is kind of futile.
Yeah. My God, Bran's already lost the use of both of his legs. He's going to get his arm chopped off and come back to the...
I don't know. Maybe.
I think you're right to have your guard up, but let's just see. Let's see how they do it. Some dragon lady wrote in and said, could Arya be no one and yet no one knows what happened to her direwolf? Could a direwolf come across her and remind her? This is a good question. What the fuck is going on with Nymeria, which is the wolf of Arya that was dismissed early on in season one after she was blamed for... well, it wasn't she was blamed. Lady Sansa's direwolf took the blame for Nymeria's crime.
Right.
And she's been at large, just hanging around Westeros, we think.
No idea.
That would be interesting if somehow this wolf reminds her of her true nature. I could see that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be kind of cool.
It comes back with needle in its mouth. Says, play with me.
It swam across. It's like this inspirational story you're going to see on Facebook. She swam across the narrow channel. She dug up needle. And then she swam back with a clutch in her mouth the whole time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Homeward bound. The direwolf story.
Yep.
That's not all the email, but it's all the email I could read on the non-spoiler section. We'll have another supersized... spoiler edition that's going to come out Friday. So if you still have some thoughts or some follow-on clarifications you want to make at gameofthrones@baldmove.com, I'll try my best to get it all in. You can also discuss it on forums at forums.baldmove.com. That's it for this week. We'll be back just five short days for the instant take podcast on Sunday.
Yeah. Until or if then. You're into spoilers, you know, Friday.
Yeah. Everybody that's not afraid of spoilers showing up on Friday. It's a good time.
Yep.
It's a crazy trip.
So, yeah, we will see you then.
Bye-bye.